This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Our Country Music Week continues today with interviews from our archive featuring two songwriters and singers who were at the forefront of the country outlaw movement, Waylon Jennings and Willie Nelson. In 1996, Willie Nelson brought his guitar to Fresh Air. He performed and talked about some of his most famous songs. He first established himself as a songwriter in the 60s with songs like Hello Walls, Crazy, and Nightlife. In the 70s, he broke through as a performer. He earned the country outlaw image through his music, stripping away the slick surface of commercial country, and with his long hair and blue jeans that defied the rhinestone style of the period's country performers. I spoke with Willie Nelson after the release of his album of gospel songs, How Great Thou Art. I asked him about the role gospel music played in his life as a child.
Well, my sister and I both were raised around gospel music and on gospel music, literally. Every Sunday, we went to Sunday school and church, and we played. We were basically the only musicians in the church. So other than there was one piano player, but Sister Bobby learned to play like her pretty quick. And pretty soon, we were the musicians of the church. So we played every song every Sunday. And we had booster bands that when I was young, we sung in those. And all through, it's Monday night was choir practice. Wednesday night was prayer meetings. And Thursday night was singing conventions in Hillsborough. So all week long, we were involved in gospel music.
Would you sing for us one of the gospel songs that you loved to sing as a child?
Sure. Let me see. Amazing grace, how sweet the sound that saved a wretch like me. I once was lost, but now I'm found. I was blind, but now I see.
I think your grandparents sang gospel too, is that right?
Yeah, my grandparents were music teachers and both vocal voice coaches and teachers, and they taught piano.
Now, one of the first songs that you wrote that got recorded was called The Family Bible.
Right.
And this was, in the late 1950s or early 1960s? I don't remember which.
This was in the 60s. I was down in Houston writing and playing down there and running into a guy named Claude Gray. And he was looking for a song to record, so I sang him Family Bible and wound up selling it to him sold it to him and two more guys for $50, I think. And it went on to be a number one record.
Did you get any royalties since you'd already sold the song?
Not really. Not really.
Would you sing us a bit of the Family Bible and tell us what went into the writing of it?
Well, this is sort of autobiographical, or practically 100% autobiographical. There's a family Bible on the table. Its pages worn and hard to read. But the family Bible on the table will ever be my key to memories. At the end of day, when work was over, and when the evening meal was done, Dad would read to us from the family Bible, and we'd count our many blessings one by one. I can see us sitting round the table when from the family Bible Dad would read. And I can hear my mother softly singing, Rock of Ages, Rock of Ages, cleft for me.
That's nice. Willie Nelson, thank you for singing that.
Sure.
What did your family Bible look like?
Oh, it was worn and hard to read. It was one of those typical old faded family Bibles where all the history was, the family history was in there, you know, all the, where all the grandparents came from and the great-grandparents. And the, it was a wonderful, it was the library, you know, or the family all sort of sit around and read, and it was very interesting. A lot of the Sunday school lessons that we learned from the Bible and things that were taken from the Bible, very interesting. And it must have been to keep a kid my age interested enough to, you know, want to sing it and want to get involved in it.
Well, I think it's very interesting that you could write compelling autobiographical songs about the family Bible and about the nightlife.
Well, they're very much involved, you know. They're very much, they're very close together. I mean, I would sing to the same people on Saturday nights in the clubs that I would sing to on Sunday mornings in church. I had to act like I didn't see them the night before.
Many people have pointed out that you have the kind of behind-the-beat phrasing that's really more associated with jazz than with country music, although I think some of the great country singers also had a wonderful behind-the-beat kind of sound. Was Sinatra a big influence on your phrasing?
Yes, he was. I don't know about phrasing. He was a big influence on my singing. There's a whole lot of the guys that I really, I felt like picked up some things from Bing Crosby and Perry Como and Ray Charles, George Jones, all the great singers.
Now, what did people like Sinatra who were you know, northern singing with big bands represent to you as a kid in Texas? Was it like a different part of American life in addition to being a different kind of singing?
Well, not really, because all the songs that I was hearing on radio, my sister and I played them and we sung them and we played them in the clubs where we were playing. We danced to them. And it's all kind of music. It was pop music, country music.
Mm-hmm.
It was all mixed together. There weren't that many labels right. In those days. It was just music. People would request Stardust, and then they would request San Antonio Rose.
You said when you were growing up, all the music kind of blended together. You were a disc jockey for a while. Did you play a wide variety of music on the radio?
Yeah, I played everything. I played everything from Patti Page's Old Cape Cod to Marty Robbins' White Sport Coat. I played everything. Anything I wanted to play. It was back in the good old days of radio when you could go in and grab your favorite records and play them.
Right before playlists told you what you're supposed to play.
Yeah.
So did you have a persona on the air? Did you go by your own name? Did you have a different voice that you used?
No, I really didn't have a different voice, but I used to open my show when I first started out. I had some disc jockey heroes that I ripped off pretty thoroughly. there was a guy named Eddie Hill out of Memphis that I stole a lot of his things from. But anyway, the way I would wind up opening my show was say, "This is your old cotton picking, snuff dipping, tobacco chewing, stump jumping, gravy sopping, coffee pot dodging, dumpling eating, frog gigging hillbilly from Hill County, Willie Nelson."
Wow. And did you write that yourself?
Well, as I said, I wrote a lot of it myself, and I ripped off Eddie and some of the other guys.
Right.
But it's some of theirs and some of mine all put together.
You must have said it a lot of times to remember that off the top of your head so well.
Yeah, I must have.
Now, how did you get to Nashville, where you started writing songs professionally?
I was living in Houston, in Pasadena, really outside, working at another radio station there. And playing at clubs at night and writing songs. And I had written, one week I'd written, Crazy Funny How Time Slips Away and Nightlife.
I'm sorry, did you say you wrote that in 1 week?
Yeah, I was working at
jeez, I wish I had a week like that.
That was a great, well, that's when I decided maybe I ought to go to Nashville. And so I took off to Nashville in my 46 Buick that just barely made it. I think it died when it hit the city limits. And went immediately to a place called Tootsie's Orchid Lounge, where I had heard was the spot to be in Nashville if you want to find some songwriters and hang out a little bit. So, and sure enough, it was the spot to be. I run into some friends of mine, Buddy Emmons and Hank Cochran. Farron Young was there, and we all got in a jam session and started singing songs, and I sung some songs to Farron. that he liked and wanted to record. So we recorded them the next week. He did two of my songs, one called Congratulations, and the other one was called Hello Walls.
So just to make sure I'm hearing correctly, you wrote Crazy, Funny How Time Slips Away, and Nightlife in 1 week?
Yeah.
Did you say to yourself, wow, these are three great songs that will become classics?
Well, I'm afraid I wasn't that knowledgeable, but I wish I'd have known then what they were going to do. Maybe it's better that I didn't. I made enough mistakes as it was. But no, I had no idea that these songs would be as successful as they have been.
Would you play one of those three for us now?
Sure.
Thank you.
Crazy. Crazy for feeling so lonely. I'm crazy. Crazy for feeling so blue. I knew you'd love me as long as you wanted, and then someday you'd leave me for somebody new. Worry, why do I let myself worry? Wondering, what in the world did I do? And I'm crazy for thinking that my love could hold you. Crazy for trying, crazy for crying, and I'm crazy for loving you.
That's such a terrific song. What came first when you were writing it? Was it the hook of Crazy?
Yeah. And then it all just sort of, you know, everything sort of came from that. And I don't know where that one came from. Maybe it was a self-analysis. It must have been.
Now, how did Patsy Cline end up recording it?
I went to Nashville and had that song and with some others. And I met Hank Cochran, who was with Pamper Music, which eventually wound up to be the publishing company that I signed with, thanks to Hank. And Hank knew Patsy. He knew her husband, Charlie Dick, and he took the song to Patsy and to Charlie. I think maybe Charlie heard it first and thought it would be a good song for Patsy. So that's through Charlie, Patsy's husband, and through Hank Cochran, she got the song. She wasn't too sure about it, and it took her a little while to... I think the first day she went into the session, she spent about 4 hours trying to sing it the way I was singing it, and it wasn't working for her. And so the next day, the producer, Owen Bradley, said, why don't you sing it like Patsy one time? And that's what she did, and that's... And that song has gone on to be the top jukebox song of all times, with Patsy Cline's recording of Crazy.
So you started to work for a music publishing company in Nashville. Did that mean you had to go to work every day and sit at a desk and write songs?
No, I'd go in every day, and me and the other songwriters would sit around and sing the songs that we had written the night before, and... that was really all we did. Being with a publishing company, the good thing about it was having other writers around, your peers, that you could play your new songs for and get feedbacks, and they play yours. And you could find out really how you're doing. When you're just writing by yourself, you really, you're in the dark a lot, and it helps to be around other writers, I believe.
Who were some of the other writers with you at the time? Anyone we'd know?
Oh, yeah, sure. You know all Hank Cochran and Roger Miller. Harlan Howard, some of the greatest writers, Wayne Walker, Mel Tillis, Ray Pennington, I mean, all these guys were around in those days.
This must have been quite an interesting environment to be working in.
It really was. It was great.
Did you ever start feeling frustrated that other people were having hits with your songs and you weren't recording yourself? Did you want to be the performer having the hits?
Yeah, I did. And yes, I was. Farron Young, who is a good friend of mine, used to tell me when I was in Nashville just writing songs, and I was raising hogs and cattle and writing the songs, and he was singing them. He said, "Now, you should never go out on the road. What you should do is stay here and write the songs and let me sing them." And I said, "Farron, but I used to have a band. I want another band. I want to go sing." He said, no, you stay here." So I'm glad I didn't listen to him, but I really couldn't because I enjoy performing more, really, than I enjoy writing. So I had to get back out.
Now, I think it was before you went to Nashville that you wanted to record your song Nightlife. Mm-hmm. And one of the producers you were working with at the time, Pappy Daly, told you that you weren't country enough. Do I have that right?
Actually, I recorded in Houston for Pappy Daly, who had a company called Glad Publishing Company, D Records for Daly. And I recorded Family Bible on that label and recorded a couple of other songs. But Nightlife, they wouldn't record it because they said it was too bluesy. It wasn't country.
Mm-hmm.
So I recorded Nightlife under the name of Hugh Nelson on another label across town, just to prove a point.
And did you prove it?
Yeah, it's that particular record, Nightlife. I think it's still the best record of it. I did it with Paul Buskirk, Herb Remington, Dean Reynolds, some of the greatest jazz and musicians around Houston.
Would you sing the song for us now and maybe tell us about writing it?
Well, this is one of those songs that I wrote the same week I wrote Crazy and Funny How Time Slips Away, driving back and forth from the Esquire Club to Pasadena every night. When the evening sun goes down, you will find me hanging round the nightlife. Ain't no good life, but it's my life. Many people just like me, dreaming of old used to be's, and the nightlife ain't no good life, but it's my life. Listen to the blues they're playing. And listen to what the blues are saying. Mine is just another scene from the world of broken dreams, and the nightlife ain't no good life, but it's my life.
What was your nightlife like when you wrote that?
I don't remember.
Oh. As if to prove a point.
Yeah.
Well, were you really cutting loose for a while? I mean, you were on your own and you were starting to make money with your career as a songwriter.
Well, yeah, I was, throwing it away with both hands. The faster I make it, the faster I would spend it. Everybody else would travel in the bus, and I was still playing bass for Ray Price when Hello Waltz made a hit, and I got my first royalty check. So I, started flying first class to all the dates. Ray's bass player, right? I'm making $25 a day. And I get a suite at the hotel. Ray's got a regular room at the Holiday Inn, and I got the penthouse. And So the checks came and went. But I had a lot of fun.
Were you married at the time?
Yeah, I was.
And did that bother you?
It bothered her.
Oh, right. When you really started recording in Nashville, your own songs, did you feel you had any trouble fitting into country music as it was?
At that time?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, I didn't. There was no slot that I fit in. I wouldn't go in that one or that one or that one. It wasn't that I wouldn't, I just didn't fit.
What were the available slots and why weren't you fitting in?
Well, my songs had a few chords in them, and the country songs weren't supposed to have over three chords.
Mm-hmm.
According to executive decisions. And if it had more than three, then it wasn't country and it shouldn't be recorded. And my voice wasn't exactly, I was nowhere near Eddie Arnold, and I was not, I guess I was closer to Ernest Tubb than Eddie Arnold, but still, my phrasing was sort of funny. I didn't sing on the beat. I had too many chords in my... I just didn't fit the slots, you know, and I wouldn't take orders. I couldn't, you know. I didn't know how to take direction that well. So I wouldn't fit in any of the slots, and so I became one of those guys that, you know, they had to call something else.
And what were you
You have
called?
To have a label, you know.
What were you called?
Well, Troublemaker at first, and then they found the word outlaw, and they decided that would smooth it out a little bit. So they started calling us that. I think the first time that term was used was in a column written by Hazel Smith, an old friend of ours from Nashville. And it took off, I guess.
You have written over 2,000 songs. Many of those songs have become hits. Many of those songs... most of us have never heard. I mean, that's a lot of songs. I would love for you to sing one of the songs that you've written that you love, that you wish was better known.
Let me think about that. Have you ever heard of a song called I Never Cared For You?
I don't think I know that.
Gives no warmth at all, and the sky was never blue. The stars and raindrops searching for a place to fall, and I never cared for you. I know you won't believe these things I tell you. You won't believe. Your heart has been forewarned, all men will lie to you, and your mind cannot conceive. Now all depends on what I say to you, and on your doubting me. So I've prepared these statements far from true. Pay heed and disbelieve. The sun is filled with ice and gives no warmth at all, and the sky was never blue. The stars and raindrops searching for a place to fall, and I never cared for you. I never cared for you. I never cared for you.
Well, Willie Nelson, I want to thank you so much for talking with us and for playing and singing for us. It's just been a pleasure. Thank you so much for being with us.
My pleasure.
Willie Nelson recorded in 1996. His latest album is called Country Music. Coming up, an interview from our archive with Nelson's friend and fellow country outlaw, the late Waylon Jennings. This is Fresh Air. Up next on our Country Music Week series, an interview from our archive with Waylon Jennings. He started his career playing with Buddy Holly and went on to change the sound of country music as a creator of the country outlaw movement. Along with Willie Nelson, he originated a sound with less strings and more rock rhythms and an image with no sequence. Being an outlaw was a very rewarding experience. Jennings had 16 number one singles and several gold and platinum albums. He also performed with Johnny Cash, Kris Kristofferson, and Willie Nelson as the group The Highwaymen. A lot of people knew him as the narrator of the TV series The Dukes of Hazzard. He also sang the theme. Waylon Jennings died in 2002 of complications from diabetes. He was 64. Let's start with a title track from his popular 1973 album Honky Tonk Heroes. The song is written by Billy Joe Shaver.
Where does it go? The good Lord only knows. Seems like it was just the other day. I was down at Green Gables, a hawking them tables, and generally blowing all my hard-earned pay. Piano rolled blues, danced holes in my shoes. There weren't another way to be. For lovable losers, no account boozers, and honky-tonk heroes like me. Hey, hey.
I spoke with Waylon Jennings in 1996 after the publication of his autobiography. Did you have a sense as a young man of what your own music was?
Now, you know, no, I didn't. I was just like everybody else. I heard somebody I liked. I loved Hank Williams. I loved Carl Smith and Ernest Tubb. And I wanted to sound like all of them. And I was in Phoenix and in a club before I really realized that I was different and that no matter how hard I tried, I couldn't imitate nobody.
What made you realize that at this club?
Well, the thing was, I was writing songs and they sounded different. They sounded, you know, I thought, man, mine don't sound like anybody else's, you know, which I didn't realize was good. You know, I thought, but you couldn't imagine it being played on radio because I would use calypso beats and hard rhythms and what have you, and they wouldn't have fit at all in on the radio in country music that way. But the way I developed my style really was getting bored. I would be in a nightclub and play for 4 hours. And you sing the song like somebody that, the guy that wrote it or the guy that sang it. And I got tired of that, so I started changing the rhythms and maybe giving it a heavier beat and just rearranging the song to fit what I felt. And it worked.
So what was the moment in which you were discovered?
Well, you know, Bobby Bear is one of the great country singers of all time. And he came through Phoenix, and he came over to this club where I was working and just flipped out. He heard, you know, we had our own sound, and I was telling you a while ago, I had my own way of doing songs and own rhythms, and I could sing, and on a lot of that helps. Well, he's playing there in Nashville, and in Phoenix, and then he's going from there to Vegas. Well, the next day when he left to Vegas, he stopped at every phone booth he saw, and he hounded Chet Atkins, saying, "You got to sign this guy." I said, this guy deserves to be on a major label. Finally, Chet called me to get Bobby Bear to shut up. And said, he's so laid back and everything. He said, we'd like to have you with RCA. He said, I like what you do. He had heard some of my demos and whatever. And he said, would you like to sign with us? And, of course, you know, that's the right hand of God is Chet Atkins. And so I signed with him, and that was it. Chet signed me without ever seeing me. You can't do that nowadays.
Why don't we hear one of the records that Chet Atkins produced of yours? And this was also your first single to reach number one on the country charts, recorded in 1968. This is Only Daddy That'll Walk the Line. Do you want to say anything about this?
Yeah, that song, Chet is all over that. Wayne Moss is playing the guitar on it, and the band is wonderful. And this song was out by someone else. And I said, well, I'd love to do that, but I'm going to give him a chance. So I waited 6 months, and then he re-released it. And I had to wait another 6 months to do it because I wasn't going to cover him.
Everybody knows you've been stepping on my toes, and I'm getting pretty tired of it. You keep a stepping out of line and a messing with my mind. If you had any sense, you'd quit. 'Cause ever since you were a little bitty teeny girl, said I was the only man in this whole world. Now you better do some thinking, then you'll find you got the only daddy that'll walk the line. I keep a working every day, all you want to do is play. I'm tired of staying out all night. I'm a coming unglued from your funny little moods. Now, honey, baby, that ain't right. 'Cause ever since you were a little bitty teeny girl, you said I was the only man in this whole world. Now you better do some thinking, then you'll find you got the only daddy that'll walk the line.
My guest, Waylon Jennings, recorded in 1968. In your book, you write, the more your records sold, the further they receded from what you had in mind, the sound you wanted to hear. What did you want, and what did you feel you were getting instead?
I wanted to recognize a record. I would do a tracks, and I'd come back, and they had put horns and all kinds of things on it. This was when Danny Davis started producing me. Chet was trying to get away from producing and more back into his own artistry and playing guitar more. And he put me with Danny Davis, and he was just overworked. But anyway, what I wanted to hear was what I was feeling and what I had in mind. It was kind of like a painting. I don't know, it sounds corny, I guess, but to me it was. I could write a song or find a song I like, and I could describe to you what it was going to sound like when I got through. And I got into a position where it didn't. And that's very frustrating and drive you crazy.
Now, I want to just take a little sidestep here into a tangent. I can't remember who was producing the session. It might have been Herb Alpert, where you decided that you just couldn't stand pickup notes. You took a gun and said what?
I took it in the studio, but it was, I think at, on that session, I think that was, I'm not sure, Danny Davis. And that was after Herb Alpert. Herb Alpert would have thrown something at me. But I did go in there. And what had happened is I'd loaned Harlan Howard,
the songwriter,
my gun. It was a bunt line. He took it out in his fishing boat. And Merle Haggard wound up with it somehow, and he brought it back to me. And so I just put on the holster, you know, I still got it and everything, and put it on. And I went in there, and I thought, well, and there were some British journalists were in there in the studio, in the little studio there at RCA. I walked in, and I said, now, the first guy that I hear use a pickup note, I'm going to shoot his fingers off. And the guy that's sitting there looking at those numbers on that paper, after the third rundown, I'm going to just kill him. Anyway, later on, I met John Lennon. And we were cutting up and everything at one of the Grammy things. And I said, "Man, you're funny. I didn't know you were funny." I said, "I thought you were some kind of mad guy or something like that." And he said, "Me?" He said, "Listen, people in England think you shoot folks."
No, explain for people who don't know written music what pickup notes are, and then tell us why you're so opposed to them.
Well, you know, it gives it away. You know, it goes dun, 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 you know, like, and there you know, why not just keep it rolling and rolling and having a good time and then come in where you're supposed to, and you haven't given everything away. You know, that's what pickup notes do, and it's an easy way, too, because it keeps, you know, you don't have to pay that much attention when you hear a pickup note coming. You know, you got to change keys.
So it's just all becoming formula to you.
It was all formula. It was like cookie cutters, you know, everything you did. And here these guys playing four sessions a day sometime. How creative can you be, you know? And they wouldn't let you use your own band. They didn't want you to use your... I'm not saying one thing bad about the musicians here. They're the greatest musicians in the world because, they had that number system, and for that music, it was wonderful. I just didn't like, you know, pickup notes, like I said. It's like, doom, 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 doom. Oh, I'm a good guy. Doom, 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 doom. That was it.
How did the Outlaw name come about?
I had an album on RCA, and it was called Ladies Love Outlaws, which was after a song, you know, and they kind of picked it up there. And then when In Search of Something, they called me everything for a long time. They called me Outlaw. They called me Rebel. They didn't know quite what pocket to put me in. But that's where it started originally. And then when they decided to put out the album with me and Tom, Paul, Jesse, and Willie, they used it there, and it kind of caught on.
That's the album Wanted the Outlaws, which was the first country album to sell a million, I think.
It was, yeah.
Why don't I play one of the recordings featured on the Wanted the Outlaws album that you did with Willie Nelson, Jesse Coulter. This is something you co-wrote with Willie Nelson, and you both sing on it. And it's A Good-Hearted Woman, which you also recorded on your own. Tell me about this particular track.
That song, Willie and I wrote that while we were playing poker one time in a hotel with Billy Gray and Paul English.
Wait, you were playing poker with Billy Graham?
Billy Gray.
Oh. I thought that sounded improbable.
Billy Graham cheats. We don't let him play no more. But anyway, and so I was recording the next day, and I said, "Willie, I like two lines in this song. You help me get them, and I'll give you half this song." So we did, but we wrote it while we was playing poker. Now, we lost our rears in that poker game, but we got a pretty good song.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Hey, I've enjoyed it. I really have. You got some good questions there, girl.
Thank you. Waylon Jennings recorded in 1996. He died in 2002 of complications from diabetes. Our Country Music Week continues tomorrow. You'll find links to all the interviews in the series on nprmusic.org. Here's Waylon Jennings and Willie Nelson singing a song they co-wrote, A Good-Hearted Woman.
A long time forgotten, dreams that just fell by the way. The good life he promised ain't what she's living today.
Really?
But she never complains of the bad times or the bad things he's done, Lord.
Yeah.
She just talks about the good times they've had and all the good times to come. She's a good-hearted woman in love with a good-time man. She loves him in spite of his ways she don't understand. Through teardrops and laughter they pass through this world hand in hand.
good-hearted woman, loving a good-hearted man.
George Clooney stars in a new movie opening today called The American. He plays Jack, an elusive gunmaker hiding out in Italy from mysterious assassins. Film critic David Edelstein has a review.
The paranoid thriller The American is spare, solemn, uninflected. It's like Camus' The Stranger and all the pulp novels in the 50s and 60s, French and American, that cribbed its existential worldview. The movie has an amoral hero with no ties who moves from country to country, sheds past lives, and either kills for money or crafts weapons for other assassins. The film is so studiously desolate that I think if at the screening I attended someone had giggled in the wrong place, it would have opened the floodgates. It would have been like Mystery Science Theater with the audience heckling George Clooney and his God's Loneliest Man act. But the silence held, and the movie cast a spell. We entered the mind of a man with no past or future, only a present made tenuous by a bullet that could come at any time. One reason for the movie's power is a shocking opening sequence, an assassination attempt on a frozen lake in Sweden. I won't spell out what happens, but it lingers in the mind for the next hour and a half. Then Jack flees to Italy, where he contacts a man named Pavel, who seems to be his employer. I say seems because the movie does little by design to orient you. Johan Lassen's Pavel has a ravaged face and a chill demeanor. He only seems curious about the woman with Jack on that Swedish lake.
Who was the girl?
A friend.
A friend?
Who are the Swedes?
I'm working on that. It's going to take some time. Did she set you up?
She had nothing to do with it.
Pity. You can't stay here. I've made arrangements for you to leave town while I sort this out. Take right outside the bar, then second left, Via Magenta. You'll find a dark blue Fiat Tempra with Pescara plates. I've marked a small town on the map, Castelvecchio. Stay there, lay low till you get my call. Don't talk to anyone. And above all, don't make any friends, Jack. You used to know that.
The American is full of passages like that, with pauses, hidden agendas, minutiae. There are long scenes in which Jack does nothing but construct a weapon to a female client's specification for purposes unknown, a machine gun with the range of a rifle, and a device to disguise the shooter's location. For a while, the only interludes of talk are Jack's exchanges with the old priest of an Abruzzo hill town. The father, played by Paolo Bonicelli, utters thesis lines like, "You're American. You think you can escape history. You live for the present." And, "You cannot doubt the existence of hell. You live in it. It's a place without love." That was where Clooney lived in his last movie, too, Up in the Air, and I get a sense he's trying to deepen his persona. That might be a doomed enterprise. Clooney is naturally gregarious, a disarmingly handsome smoothie with a toasty, caressing voice. He pulled off the brooding thing in Michael Clayton, but he doesn't here. Yes, he's magnetic, and he's lost a lot of weight for the film, trimming himself down to muscle and sinew. But when he stares blankly off screen, he's just blank. He's rather different from the loquacious and British hero of the novel on which The American is based, Martin Booth's A Very Private Gentleman, who aims to be, quote, as indistinguishable from the next man as a pebble on the beach. Clooney's the last guy I'd cast as an anonymous assassin. The Netherlands-born director, Anton Corbijn, helps by making the landscape do the talking. There are lots of paranoia-inducing overhead shots. Empty spaces alternate with twisty ancient stone stairs and shadowed passageways. As in Up in the Air, Jack does make a new friend, Clara, a prostitute played by the oxymoronically named Violente Placido. I wondered why she was so familiar with her soft, open face and voluptuous body. It turns out she's the daughter of Simonetta Stefanelli, unforgettable as Michael Corleone's doomed Sicilian bride in The Godfather. On every substantive level, The American is ridiculous. The book has a conventional whodunit solution, but the film, like Antonioni's The Passenger, leaves you with a giant why? But I enjoyed it anyway. It takes you back to an era of European angst-ridden art thrillers in which the plotting was almost abstract. The American is, well, the least American action movie in years.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Bob Purdick. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Our associate producer for online media is Melody Kramer. Sue Spolin directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.